We are solving mysteries left and right on this show.
Yeah.
After Game 7 of the Capitals series against the Pittsburgh Penguins, in which they were eliminated by the Penguins, as per usual, Barry Trotz cryptically couldn't talk about Alex Ovechkin's performance because he was too emotional to talk about it at that point. And immediately everybody said, oh, he's gone. They're going to either going to fire him. Alex is going to kill another coach. He's so mad at this guy for not performing in Game 7 and not tallying a point in Game 4 with Sid out. And he demoted him to the third line. And it's Boudreau and with Semin and Ovechkin looking sullen on the bench all over again. Cut to getaway day. Kettler Iceplex, Arlington, Virginia on Friday. Alex Ovechkin was battling a knee injury from the Kadri hit, injury from Game 3, and it turns out that Barry Trotz, rather, was just sort of like emotionally not prepared to talk about the crushing disappointment for Alex being injured in the biggest series of his life.
I'm surprised the coaches say anything after games like that, like, to be honest with you. Like, I know we always put on the highlights when someone storms out of one and kind of giggle at it, but I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. Like, when you think of all the emotional times in your life, probably the last thing you want to do is address a bunch of strangers, right? Whether it's in your career or in your personal life. Like, I get it, and it's the game, and it's the routine, and it's what everyone is supposed to do, but I don't fault Barry Trotz for not saying anything at that moment that you're going to live to regret, bear his entire soul at that moment when you don't have a chance to take a breath and have a sort of sober reflection and look back on everything instead of just going into, you know, the excuse machine, which he would get roasted for. If right away Barry Trotz starts talking about, oh, this guy was hurt and this guy was injured, this guy was dinged up, what's Barry Trotz going to hear? Ah, he's making excuses. Here we go, more excuses coming out of the Washington Capitals.
Right, right. So you wait until the official excuse day 2 days later when you clear out the lockers, which is tradition. Yeah. An amazing tradition in the NHL is nobody talks about any injury throughout the entirety of the playoffs except for Erik Karlsson. Yeah. No. And then on getaway day, on breakdown day, it's just everybody basically, yeah, you know, my spleen fell out of my butthole in game 4, and it was trailing behind me, but you know, 110%.
You see, Ottawa's, let's pause on Ottawa for a second. We had Pierre Dorion on Hockey Central today, and we asked him about that. I said, you know, what goes through your mind when your franchise player says, I have a foot injury while the playoffs are on? He said, you want the politically correct answer or the real answer? But Ottawa's weird because there's Karlsson who sort of, you know, shrugs it off like, oh, shucks, wait a minute. You mean I shouldn't have said something like that? Like, I shouldn't have done that? But I think what's hasn't really gotten much concert is Eugene Melnyk was on the Tim and Sid show a few days afterwards and was asked about Karlsson's injury. He goes, Tim McAuliffe said, well, if it were the regular season, we're not going to give us the specifics of the injury, but if it were the regular season, would Karlsson be playing? And Eugene said, no, probably not. Like, you think the White House is leaky.
Oh.
This is out in public.
We'll get to Eugene and the conference finals in a second. But let's pause on the Caps post-mortem time. I was there for Game 7. My theory before the game was completely correct, which is that they were freewheeling in Games 5 and 6. They had looked death in the face. They thought it was over. And then all the pressure left them. They were confident again. They were playing their game. They were patient. They were poised. And then they got to Game 7, and they looked up. And they saw the finish line, and they looked to the right, and they saw the Penguins, and their sphincter tightened up to the point where they're almost there. Oh, remember that scene at the end of Poltergeist when the house gets sucked into the light?
Like, yeah.
I'm surprised their entire body didn't get sucked up into their sphincter in that Game 7, much like that scene, because they not only did they play tight and not play their game that they played in the previous two games, but once the Penguins got up 2-0, they quit. They just quit.
Was it before or after Fleury made that save on Ovechkin? That blocker save that was just all world.
It was after it because it was still, I think, 1-0 at that point, right? And then,
you know, there was an interesting, because we've been talking on this podcast and elsewhere about, you know, the strength of the Pittsburgh Penguins in the offensive zone. And one of the points that I've been sort of banging with the Pittsburgh Penguins led to their two goals, which is, you know, one of the successful things that Pittsburgh's done is hold the blue line. and disrupt. And if you look at both goals, if you look at the Rust goal, like go to NHL.com and click on the highlights of both those goals. And what is the one common denominator? It's a blue line hold, but it's not just, you know, race in on the strong side and hammer a guy and try to keep the puck in. It's just get a stick in and disrupt. You know, 2017, it's the smallest thing. Get your body in front of someone. Like, just disrupt. Like, the goal of sports is to create confusion on the other side. No one does that better than the Pittsburgh Penguins. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Rust goal, who does, you know, the blue line hold and pinches down? It's Ian Cole. Right, does it lead to the Rust goal? On the Hornquist goal, it's Justin Schultz. Like, right. Both goals have the exact same thing that we've been talking about. I'm saying Don Cherry here, that we've been talking about on this podcast now for a while. That's the one thing that leads to so much success. Like, a lot of coaches would tell their defensemen, you know what, if it's a 50-50 play, just bail, take the safe way out, we'll clog up the neutral zone and take our chances on the turnover there. Not so fast with the Pittsburgh Penguins. They have speedy wingers that can get back, so the defense says, on the strong side, I'm going to pinch down a little bit here and just disrupt this breakout. Maybe get a stick in, maybe poke the puck a little bit. The reloading winger will either get back in time to clog it up in the neutral zone, or it will lead to another scoring chance. Two strong side pinches led to two goals, and that was it for the Washington Capitals. And to me, it was, if you're a Penguins fan, the perfect end, because that's how they've dined out since Mike Sullivan's been there.
Yep, I want to pause on the first goal, because that's also indicative of something the Penguins do better than anybody else. When you hear speed in this game, the first thing that comes to mind is skates. How fast does a guy skate? But it's not always that. It's how quickly you can make an effective play. And the Penguins last year quickly made effective plays in their own zone by getting the puck the hell out of there. That was speed. That's part of team speed. Here's another part of team speed. How quickly Ian Cole made that pass to Sidney Crosby while the Capitals were going one way, the play was coming another way, and it gave the Penguins numbers down low. It resulted in the goal. I love that quick little pass to Sid, who then obviously did the rest of the work to kind of get that thing going. Was so beautiful. It's not simply just keep the puck at the blue line and then keep skating to your left and wait and wait and wait and oh my god, a guy's now in front of me and I don't have a shot, but I'll shoot it anyway, and then it hits the guy and then it goes back the other way. It's make that quick play to now all of a sudden transition to a numbers game down low against the Capitals. It was brilliant, brilliant, and they do it so good.
I love defensemen that know they shouldn't have the puck on their stick too much.
Exactly. Like that's what the Penguins do.
If you're Erik Karlsson, keep the puck on your stick. If you're Drew Doughty, keep the puck on your stick. You know, Jared Spurgeon, keep the puck on your stick. But if you're Ian Cole, just have the heads up to make the play fast. Puck's on my stick. I gotta get this thing off my stick real fast here. You know, it's funny. You can kind of tell a lot about it. About a team, like when they're really clicking, like when the Penguins start to fire it around. Like, it's spectacular to watch. It says tick, 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 tick. It sounds like a watch, you know, with the puck hitting the composite sticks. It is a great, and in game six, it was terrible. Like, maybe the worst game we've seen the Pittsburgh Penguins play in, 2 years, Greg? Like, there was nothing. There was none of that zip. But then you go to game seven, all of a sudden, tick, 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 tick. The passes are crisp. The passes are hitting the blade. Good for the Penguins. I mean, I had the Caps winning that game seven. I thought Pittsburgh was dead and done, and that was it, and out of gas. And the Marc-Andre Fleury story was coming to an end. But I guess, you know, was the stat, the high percentage shooting area where he was 444 in that game six, where he's normally about a 650. You looked at that and you said, yeah, he's not going to throw two clunkers in a row like that. So maybe
they also got dramatically fewer slot chances against them in game seven than he did in the previous game. And I think that was the games one and two were game seven. It was let Fleury stand up in the first 20 minutes of the game, not allow anything. The Capitals don't really, they test him, but they're not patient. They're throwing pucks at him to see if he's leaky. And then get that one goal that makes the Capitals all boo-boo face. And I said it before and I'll say it again. Like, the word entitled gets thrown around a lot when it comes to the Capitals and their fans sometimes. But in the context of this series, in the context of the playoffs, the Capitals feel like they're owed a goal when they play well. And when they don't get one, then they get nervous and they get edgy and they start pressing. And then the other team gets one. And then they get, in the words of the great Jeffrey Merrick, boo-boo face.
They get boo-boo face. Yeah. Yeah?
Before we get too deep in this, the thing I wanted to ask you, because I know people are dying to know.
What's up?
So much talk about Ovechkin. So much speculation on your station about Ovechkin and whether he should be traded. One, should he be traded?
Move him.
Can he be traded?
How much salary are you allowed to retain? Like, he had a bad year. Like, it wasn't just the play. He had, for one thing, you know, he's going down as one of the greatest goal scorers of all time. Many believe, you know, when you weigh the era, he's the greatest goal scorer of all time. When you look at the Ovechkin era in the playoffs, he is the most, he is the best performer for the Washington Capitals, period. Mm-hmm. He just had a bad year. I don't know if it's just an off year or if it's he's 31 years old and he's played a physical style that doesn't allow you to play deep into your 30s at all. And now he's, what, 30, 31 years old? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to be hysterical and say, well, he's done. Like, that's it for Alex Ovechkin because, you know, who knows? He comes back next year and he pops 45 and then I look like a dope. But he had a bad year. Like he regular season wasn't good and playoffs wasn't good.
It bugs me when people start talking about him being done because you know what? For every Danny Heatley, there's a Jaromir Jagr. There are guys that figure out how to transition their games when they no longer have the explosive skating and when they no longer can snipe the way they used to. There are guys that can hang around this game and be really, really effective even if they're not
the
gangbuster star they used to be.
I think the question you have to ask yourself is there a common thread between players that are, like forward specifically, that are done in the early 30s versus guys like Joe Thornton that can just continue to excel season in and season out and still, you know, Ryan Getzlaff is another one. Dello was tweeting about this a while ago. I think it was Dello. And he said that, and I'll probably butcher the point, but what I took out of it was, if you predicate your game on either speed or power, you know, that can burn you out in your early 30s. But if you predicate your game on smarts, hello Joe Thornton, hello Ryan Getzlaff, you can survive. Right? Like, it's like, I was talking to a friend of mine this morning who was bringing up the case of Mike Tyson, for example. Like, even before he lost to Buster Douglas, a lot of people in boxing were saying, you know, this style that he's fighting with, you know, is not going to lead to a long career. We all thought Tyson was going to go Rocky Marciano, just go through guys, you know, finish like a 55-0 record, just mauling cats. And a lot of people said, like, look, when you look at his size and you look at the way he fights and even look at the way he trains as well, that doesn't say long career. You know, maybe there are ways to have long careers, but you just can't base your entire game on I'm getting there first or I'm the strongest guy on the ice.
Well, training's the key there too, you know. Like, I mean, that's also going back to the Jagr example. Like, that's a guy who was able to continue playing a power game because he changed the way he utilized the power. He went from being a guy who skates like a comet to basically being a low post player in the NBA, but he also did it with just with peerless training. And peerless fitness later in his career. But here's the one thing that bugs me the most about the Ovechkin trade speculation. I agree. I don't think he's going anywhere, mainly because Ted's never going to trade him. Where on earth did we ever get this idea that Vegas would be a trading partner? Like, I heard Lavoie mention that, like, on one of the Sportsnet shows, but, like,
what? So Lavoie said he's going to go to Vegas?
Yeah.
That Vegas should look because it's a George McPhee Association?
On what planet is that plausible? Like, yeah, I get it. The GM is there. But, like, I know that there's this thought that trading Ovechkin's essential because you got to do something. Got to change the mindset. You're never going to win with him. Fliggy, fliggy, flu, flu.
Okay, here's my question.
From Vegas.
Okay. It's funny. You know, Barry Trotz throws Alexander Ovechkin down to the third line with Lars Eller and Tom Wilson. And everyone says, ha, see, there you go. He's not that guy anymore. He's not your first line guy. You're not going to win with a key Alexander Ovechkin up on the first line. They lose, and he's still the center of attention. Well, hang on a second here. If he's no longer on that first line, what about the high end guys? That whether it's, you know, Nicholas Backstrom, I suppose, or Marcus Johansson, who wants to be Nicholas Backstrom, that are getting any of the criticism. Why is it all still heaped on one guy?
In this year, it's not on Backstrom. In previous years, I completely agree that I think he gets off scot-free. It's funny, like, he gets off scot-free for not performing in previous years, and then people spend the entire year going, like, well, why is he so underrated? Like, okay, well, you know, it's good that he's underrated, because otherwise he'd be pilloried for not performing as well as he should in the playoffs. This year, it's reversed. It was Ovi's bad year. It was Nick's good year. And the third line thing now comes into focus, because if he's playing on a bum knee with one hamstring, I mean, clearly Trotz takes him off the top line because he's a drag on Oshie and Backstrom.
He's injured, and everyone's saying, oh, Alex Ovechkin, look at him. Yeah, just a show pony. That's it. There's nothing there. You know, doesn't know. Come on. That's so beyond it. It's actually infuriating when I hear the conversation.
I'm a stay the course guy. I know that they're going to have to make some wholesale changes because of the fact that Williams is a free agent, Alder's a free agent, and Oshie's a free agent. I'd bring him back in a second if you can afford it. And then you've got some RFAs too. But like, I'm sorry, like the window of opportunity is not closing this team. And I know the definition of insanity. You don't have to quote it to me, but you've lost in consecutive years to a team you can't beat. Like, what happens if maybe you get one over on him? What happens if a bounce goes the right way in a game seven next year? What happens if, God forbid, somebody clears the road of the Penguins for you?
I know we're playing the ifs and buts game, but Marc-Andre Fleury's blocker is 2 inches lower than it was. Are we having this conversation?
God, he was so good in that series, though, Fleury.
He's outstanding. Jesus. It's so great to see, too. It's one of the greats, saying before on the podcast, cheer for people, man. He's one of those guys you have to cheer for.
It's hilarious to me that this franchise has been criticized so much in the past for overreaction and for moves that defy logic but are made emotionally, like turfing Boudreau. And now we're talking about, like, break up the team because they won the President's Trophy and lost a game seven in the second round. So we're gonna just nuke the team. Come on.
No, you're not. You're gonna come back with basically the same team next season.
Yeah.
Minus a couple guys.
Right.
That's it. And you see what happens. 82 games is a long time. Who knows what's gonna happen to the Pittsburgh Penguins next year? Who knows what's gonna happen to Columbus? Who knows what's gonna happen to the Philadelphia Flyers? Who knows?
I'm gonna write this, and it's a spoiler warning. But here it goes anyway. A few years ago, the template for the Washington Capitals was the Boston Bruins. They looked at the Bruins winning that cup, and they said, there's a team that got a lot of criticism, but they didn't break themselves up. They made a few changes, they kept the core, and look what happened, they won a cup. Now it's time for them to look to another model of recent somewhat success, and that's the San Jose Sharks. You're a veteran team with a veteran core that never wins in the playoffs. Don't break them up, but maybe take the C off your guy and give it to Nick Backstrom. Maybe do that. Maybe that's the thing you do.
Do you really want that sidebar to the entire season?
Do you really want to help alleviate the pressure on Alex Ovechkin?
Does it matter that much, really? Like, and here's another question I think you have to entertain. What positions can you affect the most change on a game? Center? Certainly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Defense? Absolutely. Goalie? Easy. Number one. Mm-hmm. How easy, or more accurately, how difficult is it to impose your will on a game from the wing?
Let me just thank you right now for saying this and winning all of my arguments about Taylor Hall and his inability to, quote, make his teammates better in New Jersey.
Like, there's a handful of wingers that make everybody better around them. That's why Pat Kane's a freak.
Yeah.
But generally, your wingers ain't doing it. They can help drive a line, certainly true. But when you want to talk about, like, the imprint on a game, like, are we asking Ovechkin to do things that normally we assume that goalies, defensemen, and centermen can do? Isn't it the hardest place to really affect any change in the game? And we're judging Ovechkin by a standard that's been set by people in positions that affect the game more profoundly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why the Sid versus Ovi thing was always just ridiculous.
Two different positions.
Two different positions, yeah. Also, one is demonstrably the best player, one of the best players of all time in every facet of the game. And one is just a singular talent of his generation.
One of them might be the best goal scorer of all time.
Yeah, but not the best player of all time.
And here's the thing. If he turns into a two-way player and they don't win, like if all of a sudden he turns into Yuri Lehtinen, like, okay, that's it, I'm focusing on, like, I'm back-check Alex here. and he only gets 25 goals and the Caps go out in the first round, what's everyone saying? Guy, we pay you to score goals.
Yeah, I know, right?
Can't win.
What do you think of, we'll talk plenty about Nashville and the Ducks in a second with Pete Weber, but what do you think about the Sens and the Pens?
This is tough sledding for the Ottawa Senators. I really want, I always cheer for the best stories with the you know, people with, like, whether it's Bobby Ryan or whether it's Craig Anderson or, you know, whether it's Clark MacArthur. Like, I really want this Ottawa story not to stop. And it has nothing to do with, you know, my birth certificate. It has nothing to do with my media affiliation. I just really want these guys to be successful. You know, what Bobby Ryan has gone through, what Clark MacArthur has gone through, and what Craig Anderson has gone through. I really want those guys to be successful. I want Brian Murray to win a Stanley Cup.
Yeah, right. Right?
Like, I want, I love that. That's my heart. But my head is saying the Penguins. And the other side of our story to all that is, I don't know that we're giving the story of, you know, here's a team that might be the first in the salary cap era to repeat enough concert.
Yeah,
I don't
exactly.
know. Maybe it takes another round until you have that conversation. But that's hard, man. Like, that's one of the things we've learned going back to 2005. Dude, it's hard. We think Chicago 3-6, but it's hard, man. It's hard to win back-to-back. It's hard to keep teams together. And there's, you know, at a, what, 95, 97% retention rate, there's the Pittsburgh Penguins. In Chicago every year. Whether they win the cup or not, they got to get rid of players. How do you retain that many players from year in to year out? Penguins have done it.
And also, you have the inexplicable ability to win without significant players in your lineup. Which is, I mean, I can't, the Penguins are on another level when it comes to that kind of stuff. And you know what? The reason I haven't been six in this series, I think Ottawa's going to be a tough out. They play a really stubborn style of hockey that I think is going to earn them a couple wins in this series.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like, the thing that they're not going to do is frustrate the Penguins. Like, there's going to be a game that the Senators win 1-0. And everybody's going to go to sit on all them after the game and be like, are you frustrated offensively with what Guy Boucher's team's doing across the ice? And they're going to be like, no, we're fine. That's because they're fine. They're the most poised, confident, believing in their own abilities group that we've seen in a really long time. Game 7 against the Capitals was a complete indication of that. They know that if they play their game and execute their game plan, as cliche as it sounds, they could beat anybody, and they're not going to be flapped by Guy Boucher's system.
I asked Pierre Dorion this on Hockey Central this afternoon, and he wouldn't bite. I'll see if you will. You have to like what Ottawa did at the trade deadline, because you look around the Atlantic and you say to yourself, Montreal still has Carey Price at least for one more year. The Maple Leafs are getting better. Now we know the Boston Bruins are better. We know Tampa will be back in this mix next year. We strongly suspect the Florida Panthers will be improved. Maybe the one year where it's wide open in the Atlantic is this season, and we need to go for it.
That's
we need to make the move for Burrows. We need to make the move for Victor Staal. We need to do those things, because we can't be guaranteed that next year we're even going to be in a playoff position. No one can guarantee that, because everybody in the Atlantic, you can even make the argument for Buffalo, and we'll see what Jason Botterill does, could be an improved team as well. Everyone in the Atlantic's going to improve, we strongly suspect, for next season.
First of all, the Botterill pick is great. I don't know if I love the fact that Tocchet might be the coach, but I think the GM's the right guy, and I'm happy he got his gig. And I don't know if we've ever talked about it or if it's just been said inside conversations, but the idea that he was someone who was overqualified for gigs but couldn't get him because he was a bad interview was brought up a few times.
Oh, really? I never saw that. Really?
Yeah, that was. And so I'm happy that he got this, because I think he deserves it.
Do you think they're done hiring? Because I still think that there's one. I'm not talking about a head coach. I'm talking like senior advisor, you know, Brian Burke to Brad Treliving.
Are you saying that a well-manicured man who used to maybe be a general manager in California who was a funny way of making problems disappear with drugs at the border.
With a USA hockey background, I don't know if it's going to be Dean Lombardi, but don't you
Jason,
get the sense that there's going to be one more executive hiring here?
Jason, let me tell you about this Roman general that I know. I would hope that that's the case. I think the model is the brain trust now. What Toronto's done, what Pittsburgh has done to a certain extent. is the model, and I think that's the right way to go. And I don't think they Detroit. Had that model under Tim.
Detroit did it. You know, I'm name dropping like crazy on today's show. I know. I was on Primetime a couple weeks ago, and Brian Brick was in the studio. And I asked him about the structure, right, between him and Brad. And he talked about how he made it, how this is something I'd never considered before. He said, what people don't take into account, and I think he's right, is how lonely it can be being a general manager. When you don't have anyone, you have no one to talk to. He said his first deal when he was with Hartford, that would have been the Bobby Holik deal. So he's about to call Lou in New Jersey. And he picks up the phone. He's young. Picks up the phone, hangs it up. Thanks. Picks up the phone again, hangs it up. I think they got Sean Burke the other way. Picks up the phone again, hangs it up. Goes for a walk. Goes and walks around the building. No one to talk to. Finally says, like, oh, it's, you know, okay, I got to do this. I got to picks up the phone, hangs it up again. He said he had no one to talk to. And he really, and even after he made the deal, I mean, hanging up the phone, and there was this feeling of emptiness because there's no one to talk to about it. And after a while, when you've made a bunch of these deals, you can deal with that. But when it's your first few deals, he said that can be overwhelmingly lonely. And as there's a lot more, as the NHL transitions into general managers now in their 40s who haven't done this on their own before, I wouldn't be surprised if this is now the model for a lot of teams going forward.
Let me read you from the New York Times.
Okay.
This is August 1992. This is from about the Holik trade. Lou Lamoriello, the president and general manager of the Devils, defended his decision to part with Eric Weinrich in the deal by saying that
Weinrich and Burke? Was it Weinrich and Burke?
Okay. For Holik and picks. By saying the Devils wanted to make room for Scott Niedermeyer, an 18-year-old phenom whose offensive attributes as a defenseman are considered by many to be in the class of a Paul Coffey or a Brian Leetch. In addition, the emergence of Miles O'Connor and the decision to re-sign defenseman Tommy Abilene apparently encouraged Lamoriello to part ways with the 25-year-old Weinrich. There you go. The emergence of Miles O'Connor and the re-signing of Tommy Abilene. Oh, also this Niedermeyer kid that's been kicking around the old system.
Yes, fella from Kamloops we seem to have stumbled upon in the draft. I don't know. Scouts say he seems to be okay. But this kid from Michigan, Miles O'Connor, he's the real deal. That's the guy.
Miles and Miles O'Connor. Yeah, that's a hell of a thing. No, that's a good point. But to go back to your original question before we, as is tradition, got on a bit of a tangent. Yeah, I think the window was this year. But on top of all of that said about the division, you know why else the window is this year?
What's that?
Because Guy Boucher has an expiration date. And he is one of those guys that gets you a lot of success early. And then eventually somebody says, you know what?
Pete's there, fellas.
I kind of hate playing this way. I don't think I want to play this way anymore. So I think this was also a very much window of opportunity year because they're all buying into what he's selling.
Interesting. Our guest is standing by. Let's get right to him. He's an important person, and he's got a job to do tonight.
Pete Weber is the voice of the Nashville Predators, and by God, we've been doing this show forever, and we finally have a chance to talk to Pete this late in the season.
It's nice.
It is nice to talk to you this deep into the season, this deep into the playoffs. We've been talking a lot about, you know, momentum and does it exist? And I'm not even sure that momentum exists, you know, from shift to shift, let alone period to period, let alone game to game, Pete. So should we put any stock at all in the fact that Nashville beat Anaheim last season in the playoffs, or should we just park that?
I think we should just park it. And I know that head coach Peter Laviolette feels the very same way. You know, if that were the case, you know, we shouldn't play these things. And these poor sponsors' messages would not get through to the populace out there. It would be nice if you could say that that carries over, but I don't think it does. And I agree with you about even from shift to shift. Momentum is a concept that I don't think sees that much in terms of reality.
I think you're probably right on that one. The most, let's get right to my most fascinating thing about the series. I want to see that Kessler, Cogliano, Silverberg line up against that Johansson, Forsberg, Arvidsson line, and may the best line win. That's all I want from this series.
Yeah, I think that could be a great deal of fun, much like it was in Chicago with Jonathan Toews and the cast of thousands that ended up flanking him during the course of that series. I mean, you know, everything was all, you know, chiseled in stone, and not necessarily just written down in ink, but chiseled in stone. And that got broken up because of a lack of success against that group. That group was not quite as prominent in the St. Louis series, but as far as Nashville Predators fans are concerned, the guy who wears the black hat in the NHL is Ryan Kesler.
He is, and he's horrible to play against, and he's a lot of fun to watch because it usually produces chaos. Hey, Pete, at what point this season, and maybe it was that post-January run to the end where the record was like 30-15-2 or something, that Nashville won this insane, at what point did you say to yourself, watching this team, knowing everything you know about all the players, all the personnel, did you say to yourself, I think we got a really good playoff here, team here, boys?
I think I was one of those who was, even though I wasn't born in Missouri, probably was more of that show me attitude. Mm-hmm. And I feel that when I really picked up on it and felt that the belief was being manifested on the ice with results was probably after game two of the Chicago series. And then further reinforced with the Kevin Fiala overtime winner in game three. That's been a thing, sort of thing that has been like momentum. But not that you know his characters carried from game to game. They generate it every time. That's the thing. This club is so focused on the business at hand. You and I, we all look at these calendar planners every day. Well, the Predators just look at the calendar page for this day and attend to business in that fashion.
Businesslike is the word, I believe. Pekka Rene is so damn good in these playoffs. Did you ever think he was going to be this damn good in these playoffs?
A few years ago, perhaps. And then, you know, this year you're wondering if this, what's that great phrase we use for Super Bowl teams, is the window opener, is the window closing. But really, from about November on, I've had a very difficult time finding a game where you could say a couple got away from him. He has been very good, and now the defense around him is essentially not allowing much in the way of rebound tries, set up so that he can see everything. It's like Scotty Bowman always says, the big change of the game from when he coached, and that was a long period of time, but to today is he thinks every team employs six goaltenders. Everybody's out there trying to block shots. But when these guys block shots, Pekka still has a way of being able to eye them all the way.
You know, interesting about the idea of, you know, the six goaltenders out there, and it's always interesting to see which defense pair various coaches want out there against the other team's top line. And this is no disrespect to Roman Josi and Ryan Ellis and that pair, but when Peter Laviolette needs a shutdown pair out there, when, you know, Chicago's top line is out there, it's Ekholm and Subban. When the Tarasenko line is out there, it's Ekholm and Subban. The Subban story has been well told. Is not the secret weapon on the Nashville Predators Matthias Ekholm, still amongst the top, if not number one, when it comes to shot suppression around the NHL, yet no one seems to talk about Ekholm, and he may be, when it comes right down to it, the most effective blue liner of the group.
Peter Laviolette talks about him in that fashion quite a bit. And as you say, his words are spoken with whom he puts out on the ice in those situations. No, I think he is a guy, I don't know if I can say he's the guy that makes a goal, but I think you can make the argument that he is. He just needs to have a fake Twitter account like the Captain Ryan Ellis Twitter account for the entertainment of us all.
Now, Ellis has had that beard for all the season, yeah?
Yes, he has.
So that's we can't pray. Where do you fall on that, Pete, as far as playoff beards go? Can you count beards that started early in the season, or does it have to be foliage and roughage that just started when the playoffs did?
Yeah, I think it has to be from I will allow from the night the regular season ends. After that, I have a little bit of a difficult time with that. And I'm still wondering, you think now, do either Brett Burns or Joe Thornton eat vegetable soup at this time now with those beards filtering all that?
Throw Patrick Eves into that conversation as well. Why not? He seems to have the market cornered there in Anaheim.
Patrick Eves will never again enter a season without the beard. because if the Samson theory were to be proved, it would be if he were to enter next year clean shaven and can't score anymore.
That's a good point. Hey, speaking of not being able to score anymore, horrible injuries I saw with Kevin Fiala, who was really rounding out to being, you know, a legit, you know, top six force with the Nashville Predators. I saw that, you know, he was, you know, around to rally the last series for the Nashville Predators. Does he still – teams are different. But does Nashville still keep Kevin Fiala around, or are the Nashville Predators one of those teams that if you're injured, we don't want you around the group at all?
Well, they're not keeping him around for this road trip, but I know he's going to be back there. He was the other day to a practice, too. So he will be around in that form, yes.
Now, we've talked to you a lot in the past about Nashville as a hockey town and the fan support and everything. Tell us about what it's like now that this team is in the third round. Where are we? Has the bandwagon expanded? Are the local news weathermen and women all wearing jerseys during their stand-ups outside now?
Pretty much. And to the best of my knowledge, and I don't have video surveillance cameras, I believe they wear them to bed, too. Now, when I find out, I'll let you guys know. But I do have that very deep suspicion, because rarely did I see them without them on. So it's like it's become secondary nature to them to be clad in such a fashion.
Now, through all of this, I would imagine that our favorite pro wrestler slash hockey fan, Eric Young, would be all over the Preds. I know you've at least gone to lunch a couple of times with the man we used to call Showtime, Eric Young. Where's Eric through all of this? He must be in a frenzy over how well Nashville is doing.
He is tweeting quite a bit about it. I hope to have game day lunch with him on Tuesday before game three at Bridgestone Arena, just to maybe help him. Maybe I'll play the role of a leech and bleed away a little bit of the overexuberance he might have.
Yeah. calm it down a little bit, young man.
All right. What do you think is the overarching, overriding key to this series for the Predators to advance to play for the Cup?
To continue to just be focused on the job today, tonight, and not think about anything beyond that. I really think that is it. That's what they, obviously, through the first two series, bought into from head coach Peter Laviolette. And I think if they do that, they'll be in pretty good shape. It's not going to be easy, but I think if they keep their attention to that. And I think St. Louis was a good preparation round for the Ducks, because that means you've got to be patient, maybe when you don't wish to be patient. And I guess I'm speaking in this case about number 17 of the Ducks.
It was on this day in history, by the way, Pete, that David Poile, I think it was today, that was fired from the Washington Capitals as their general manager. And as I think about GMs around the NHL, you know, one of the only GMs that shows that you can do it not just a traditional way of, you know, long-term pain and drafting and developing, but you can do it if you're shrewd and if you pay attention by trading for not only a first, you know, a number one defenseman, but also a number one center. You know, in a lot of ways, David Poile, he's looking around the NHL and saying, there's more than one way to construct a team here. We've made this point countless times in the podcast. As much as this team is, you know, drafted, developed all the traditional way, I don't know any other team at the elite level that's done more by way of trading for top position than the Nashville Predators.
And while it all hasn't all been by trade, it was trading away of the captain, Shea Weber, and trading away Seth Jones to get Ryan Johansson to finally have a number one centerman. But think of the other guys that have walked here. In 2012, it was Ryan Suter. The year prior to that, it was Dan Hamhuis. And still, to have the basis of a defense that they have here right now, that I think probably is the best of those remaining in the playoffs.
I would agree
with that. It's true. And you know what? It's funny, too, because if you look at, and if you have a look at the draft, and last year, there it is, Dante Fabbro, they go right away.
Yeah.
It seems if the organization now is saying, okay, we've spent a lot of time the past few years in the draft trying to, you know, restock up front. Now we need to start to look at that next sort of wave of defensemen when this group is ready to move along. So they're starting, at least now, to address that with the acquisition of Dante Fabbro last year of the draft.
The only problem I had with Dante was he was telling me his sisters play soccer at Austin Peay University in Clarksville, Tennessee, and they go to Nashville, it takes them 20 minutes. Well, if they're taking 20 minutes to go, the state troopers must just be waving so long. I'm not going to try to catch those two troops. That's about a 40-minute drive, guys.
That's a good point.
But I thought that was rather better. Now, you know, today also is the one-year anniversary of the latest the Predators had ever played. It was a year ago today they lost Game 7 in San Jose. And,
is that
you know,
right,
you thought, as we talked about, you know, windows of opportunity, you wonder, you know, what that was like at that point in time. Because I remember the utter disappointment in Music City about that and in the Predators' office. And yet here they are now, and it is guaranteed they will play longer than May the 12th this season.
Indeed. Well, Pete, we hope they keep on playing because you're one of our favorite people, and this has been a long, long... I mean, there was that time when they had Sergei Krizakrazov. Well, I'm talking a very long time for this to happen.
You know, what I knew wish that hockey had made it in the South was when I'm downstairs after a game that first season, and I heard this going through the bowels of the arena with the fans waiting for autographs. Hey, Sergei, how about an autograph? And I knew right then and there this was the beginning of something big.
Indeed. All right, Pete, thank you so much, man. And
thanks, Pete.
We'll talk to you soon.
And just to let you know, I did bring my toys with me.
Attaboy. It's got to be a Slapshot reference in there. Reg, that reminds me. I was coaching in Omaha. Eddie Shore sends me this guy. Anyway, we'll move along.
Back in 1948. What was his name again?
He used to take deliberate penalties, Pete. What was his name? Anyhow, always good catching up. Just all
by
himself. Thanks, Pete. No one loves Slapshot more than our man Pete Weber.
Rangers Report 2.0 wants to know, curious, will you actually do listener questions today on MVSW?
Fine.
No,
do some. Go for it. You want to do some? Let's do some.
All right.
Cheaping out lately.
Sal Rotman wants to know, what's your take on the role of luck? Is the analytics community overstating this?
No, I don't think so. I really don't. I really don't think that. I think luck is a huge part of it. When coaches hate to say it, but I think the reason why coaches put so much stock in things like faceoffs is because it's something that's quantifiable, right? You can look at it, and there's a stat that shows up on a piece of paper, and it makes everyone feel really, really comfortable. But coaches get wiggly when you talk about things that can't really be controlled and are just sort of random events. And these are all bodies that are, you know, sort of moving in concert in different ways, and a rubber puck and cold ice
and high goalies.
I really do think that luck is a huge part of it. And you need luck along the way to win the Stanley Cup. You need luck along the way to win a period.
It's been an interesting postseason for the analytics community. I think you could look at what happened with the Minnesota Wild, where by every metric they should have won that series or at least done better in that series than they did, and just say, okay, sometimes Jake Allen happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, Randy Carlyle was a guy that was really crucified by the analytics community for existing, and now his team's in the conference final.
Yep, certainly are. You're a really good team they have there.
It's kind of a weird spot to be in, but we digress. Puck and Hostile wants to know specifically from you, what do you think of this Spectre nonsense? I'm guessing it's Mark Spectre. About
I haven't seen it. I saw the tweet.
Cutting goalie sticks off at the blocker? Why? So they can't make knob saves? Is that the deal?
So they can't poke check? I'm not sure what Spec's getting at. For it, because I haven't seen either what he said or what he wrote. I'm assuming that the idea is goaltenders are too busy and have too many weapons either to play the puck and fire it back out of the zone, essentially becoming a third defenseman, or poke checking the puck, I suppose. I don't know. To me, if it's a way to increase goal scoring, which everyone seems to be on the same page about, I think we're all, you know, dancing around. We're sort of picking away at the edges, you know, also like, oh, you got to shave the goaltending stick down. Oh, we got to take an inch here and an inch there off the goaltending equipment, failing to realize, you know, that we all think that it's going to go back to 1970s and 1980s standards of goaltending when the goaltenders were terrible. Like, we all think that if you shave the equipment down, all of a sudden goaltenders in 2017 will start playing like the goaltenders of 1983 with kick saves. It's not going to happen. You know, the big issue is everybody blocks shots right now. Everybody gets in front of it.
Let's go. Let's.
I'm guessing that's what Spec would be getting at. You want to increase goaltending by taking a something that can help a goaltender away from him.
Yeah, I mean, let's not see
what he said.
Let's not have him be third defenseman back there. Let's just play with cardboard cutouts. Let's not actually have a human.
Just shooter tutors. Just shooter tutors in there. Yeah. Okay.
Why not? Grumpy Ice has one of those questions that you find so crunchy. One of those speculative, what if we reinvented the game kind of questions.
All right.
Thoughts on the idea of UFAs and eliminated teams having the ability to be added to playoff teams for compensation?
In junior hockey, here I go. In junior hockey, what you used to be able to do is pick up a goaltender before you played in the Memorial Cup. Did you know this? Think about it now. It's so dodgy. It's so goofy. But when your team went on to play in the Memorial Cup, you were allowed to take a goaltender from another team. You know, John Garrett ended up doing this. I think Mike Vernon ended up doing this as well. So like you would play like your whole season with Lethbridge, and then like New Westminster would make it into the Memorial Cup, and you'd be able to pick up Lethbridge's goaltender
to play in it.
So it has happened in hockey.
It kind of reminds me of like a video game where you reach a certain point in your journey to beating the game, and there's like a board where you just go there and collect weapons. You just get a bunch of weapons and suit up and power up and stuff.
Hey.
And then you continue on your journey. I kind of love the idea of, like, if you've earned your chance to be in the Final Four, if you're the Predators, the Ducks, the Senators, or the Penguins, you get a 24-hour window to trade assets for unrestricted free agents and power up.
Wow. You know, here's something. I want to make sure I get this on the podcast because it's a really interesting idea. I think we're all on the same page that we hate the video review for the offsides because we're really, really splitting hairs, right? It's like so freaking close that we all end up sort of rolling our eyes about it.
But Merrick, what about the integrity of a goal being scored on a play that may involve several different instances of obstruction or tripping or holding or hooking?
We got to make sure that
they're onside.
Then we'll do it on video review on dump-ins then too. So let's not get rid of it. Let's expand it for the integrity of the goal. Steve Fallon, who's a lead researcher at Sportsnet Hockey, he's a fantastic guy and smart dude. He texted me this the other day. Because I think he's annoyed by it, too. He says, how about this as a way to curb the automatic review for that offside that we all hate? It's so close and just chews out minutes of the game, bores everybody. Instead of just losing your timeout, you get a minor penalty. So if you think it's offside, you're risking putting your team down 2 minutes. You better really be sure. That way, it's got to be like a good foot to make sure. That way, you get rid of that. Oh, is it an inch this way or an inch that way? And is the heel off? Like, his point is losing the timeout isn't enough of a punishment. Make it a minor penalty if you're wrong.
I like that.
That way, there's none of these like really close ones that get called. Where we're all kind of like, you know what? Close enough. Good. Just play on. Let's not slow. This game that's supposed to be the fastest in the world down anymore. And you know what? If you call it and you're really sure about it, you shouldn't have to worry about getting penalized because it's a really egregious offense. Mm. 2 minute minor, buddy. Let's see the GMs chew on that one next meeting.
Oh, they've got so much other stuff to chew on, like the concussion spotter protocol. I know. We haven't done a show since then. Real quick, what did you think of that? He should have been pulled, right?
My head says, yeah, I saw that.
Your eyes say no because you obviously read the criteria, as Bill Daly said. And
I didn't know that criteria. I didn't. I didn't know the idea that you can't use the boards as a weapon or the boards can't sort of be weaponized or is something that helps produce a concussion is something that needs to be looked at again. But my first thought watching him, you know, go accordion style into the boards – is I just hope he can stand up and skate off. Like, I'm like, my first thought is, here comes the stretcher.
Well, he shouldn't have been pulled. Why? He was punched in the face. Yeah, but the rules say fist. It doesn't say knuckle.
Dude, listen, how many times remember that Montreal-Chicago game where Corey Crawford took one right between the lookers from Shea Weber and went back like Nestie plunge style.
Yeah.
And I still don't know how he wasn't taken off the ice.
I still think the goalie situation is one of the reasons why this thing doesn't have any teeth. I think they're scared to death of people taking advantage of the protocol for goalies. I think they're scared to death. Like they're scared to death that it's going to be a situation in a game seven where...
Can I just waste them? Waste them at the goalie's head?
Let me just pick a guy's name out of a hat. Milan Lucic comes through the crease and just chicken wings a goalie, and then he has to leave the game. Like, that's what they're worried about.
Game seven, Maple Leafs, St. Louis Blues, 1993, and Wendell Clark just wastes one up 3-0 on Curtis Joseph's head.
Yeah.
Coming to screaming down the right side.
Yeah. I think that's what they're really worried about. All right, real quick before, because then you got a boogie. I'm saying Pens in six, Preds in six. What do you say?
Sounds right to me. Yeah, if I was picking that. But I really want, just for the human interest story. Although, man, I love the Fleury story. Ah, I hate freaking picking Pittsburgh and Ottawa because I love the human interest stories on both sides. But I got no problem taking Preds. I'll take Preds in six. And the other one, I hate choosing because I love some of the stories on both.
I love the Penguins and Predators. I think it's the sexiest matchup on the board still. And I think it's going to be a really easy series from a travel perspective for your old boy, Greg Wyshynski. No customs at the border. And then some real party time in Nashville for what will probably amount to be about three games there, I would imagine.
Please say hello to all of our friends, including the aforementioned Eric Young for me.
Oh, man. Dude, it's going to be... That series, if it's the Penguins and Predators... will be so much fun because the Penguins have, you know, obviously their fan support, but people tuning in and seeing that atmosphere in Nashville for the first time if they haven't been following the Predators.
Totally.
My God.
Totally.
It's going to be like a college game.
That's awesome. It's amazing. Right. Go Preds.
Thanks everybody for listening and for your questions and such. And Jeffy and I will talk to you next week. And thanks to Sam
I'll be in Windsor for the next show.
Oh, brilliant.
World Cup, I'll leave on Wednesday.
And thanks to Sammy for hooking up the show before his big steamy date today.
Lance Romance, look at you. Hey, honey, Owen Sounds not in the playoffs anymore.
Sam legit said that we had to do the show before a certain time tonight because we had a date.
I got super exclusive tickets for my girlfriend and I, so I'm super fired up about it.
What are you going to see?
Wouldn't you like to know?
Oh, what kind of tickets?
Maybe a little dance. Who knows?
What kind of show you going to, Sammy?
It's actually a band called Mac DeMarco. It's a Canadian band.
Where are you going to see them?
Danforth Music Hall.
Oh, dude, that's a great spot.
Yeah, it's one of the best venues in Toronto, actually. So
that
I'm really looking
really
forward
cool
to it.
That's a really cool spot. Oh, dude, have fun.
That is
a great spot.
That's
right around the corner from where you are now. You can stumble.
Yeah. Now I got to go home and get looking good, you know? Got to get the gel in the hair and...
That's
why Sammy's the best producer in all of radio, because we're like, hey, we really need to do a show. It's the beginning of the third round of the playoffs. And Sammy's like, well, I give you this two-hour window, because then I got to get to boning.
Not saving this one for the shower. This one's for the lady.
All right. We'll
boys.
Talk to you guys next week. Goodbye. Thank you.